Welcome back to Shattering Mist. We're continuing with our revelations from Yahweh, considering what he etched in stone. This is the third statement on the first of those two tablets, his instructions, 77 Hebrew words on each of the two tablets. On the first tablet, the 77 words cover three statements. The first introduces us to Yahweh by name. He says that he is not only God and the only God, he also says that he is our Savior, that he descended to lead us away from the crucible of Egypt, which is a metaphor and an historic marker both for religious and political oppression, and that he freed us, which is tells us that the Torah and its teaching are liberating. And he said that you will not exist with any other God in my presence. So if you're going to incorporate aspects of religious myths, then from God's perspective, you will cease to exist. The second of the three statements is very long. It covers many topics. It begins with a admonition not to be religious. It just says, I don't want you speaking for religious symbols. I don't want you paying homage to religious or political symbols. I don't want you acknowledging them or bowing down to them. I don't want you worshiping them. I don't want you in any way, shape, or form to associate with or show homage to a religious or a political artifact or entity. He then transitions to say that he is a zealous and jealous God, that he's not going to share us. He's not going to tolerate his children being corrupted by these institutions. He then says that fathers corrupt their children, speaking on the same subject, that an adherence to patriotism and politics and religion is the perversion and twisting of one's children. And it happens generation after generation. To this, he says that the solution is to walk to him in love, of which he has provided a path, the same path that he used in the Exodus, which was what he described as his means to save us in the first of those statements. He then says that in addition to that, those who receive his mercy, and he quantifies it as saying that it's thousands amongst billions is one in a million, do so by closely examining and carefully considering the terms and conditions of his covenant relationship. That leads us to the third statement, and it reads, you should never deceive or delude through the name or reputation of Yahweh, your God, advancing worthless and lifeless deception. For indeed, Yahweh will never forgive or leave unpunished those who constantly and consistently deceive, actually beguile, and habitually delude in association with his name and reputation to promote and effect vain and ineffectual lies which lead to lifelessness and destruction. Now, here there are two words that are germane to our understanding of this statement. It is not, by the way, a commandment. It's not written in the imperative mood. It is a statement. And in this statement, that is whether Yahweh meant to convey nasha, which means to lift up, to tolerate, to embrace these things which are lifeless and destructive, which would speak to the adherents of religion, the victims of religion, or if it is nasha with the sh sound and therefore speaking of the perpetrators of religion, those who actually deceive and delude. So there is a question there as to whether or not, in the broadest sense, it includes both the perpetrators and the victims of religion, or does it just include the perpetrators by the choice of nasha versus nasa as the verb. And then in a moment we'll also consider the nature of Shoah and what it reveals to us about the corruption that religious individuals have perpetrated on the divine text. So with death and damnation, and it's really death or damnation, Yahweh uses naka to speak of forgive or leave unpunished as the consequence here. serving is the as I say, the consequence of failing to embrace this instruction, it is reasonable to conclude that the crime has to be serious. This is the only unforgivable crime in the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. The only unforgivable crime. Now, there are places where God says, you know, if you do these things, you're going to die. Yeah, but dying is not a punishment. Dying is just simply the consequence of living one's life apart from Yahweh, apart from the covenant. Set apart to the world as opposed to set apart to God. The only place where he says, if you do this, it's not forgivable. Now, I want to, before I go on here, I want to state two things very clearly. One is that the purpose of the Torah, and it's the path that we walk to God and become perfect, is to perfect flawed individuals. In other words, the whole purpose of the Torah and Yahweh's means to save us is that he recognizes that we are not perfect, that we are flawed, and therefore he has a remedy for that. And the Torah is the remedy for sin. This notion that if you violate one aspect of the Torah, you're guilty of all of it, is only true if you take it out of context and recognize that the purpose of the Torah is to guide us to our own redemption. So it resolves that problem. Now, the second thing that I want to say is that this admonition was written in the imperfect, which speaks of ongoing behavior, so that if you consistently and continually deceive, actually beguile, or habitually delude, then you can't be forgiven, according to God. God is saying emphatically, if you consistently and continually deceive, you cannot be forgiven. Now, I was a deceiver. I was both religious and political. I was active religiously and politically. I was a trained evangelist. I was an ordained ruling elder in the Presbyterian Church. I led Bible studies. I preached from Pauline text. I was a deceiver. But you see, I'm no longer deceiving. I have rejected that. I have denounced my political affiliations. I have denounced my patriotism. I have denounced my association with the religion of Christianity. I am no longer deceiving. The moment you cease deceiving, you are no longer someone who is habitually or continually deluding. And that's the beauty of every one of these statements that Yah writes, is they're written in the imperfect conjugation, which means that in every one of the seven instructions that will follow, including this particular statement, it's the ongoing and habitual and continual deception, or in the case of murder, or in the case of killing, in the case of lying, it's if you just continue to do it throughout your life, then that's the problem. If you stop, because you've come to know Yahweh, because you've come to respect his guidance, because you've embraced his teaching, you've incorporated his guidance into your life, then you're no longer someone who is held accountable to the standard because you've stopped. So those are the two things I want to share with you before we dig back into these words. So in this light, it's hard to miss the fact that lo nasa, you should not lift up or bear, you should not accept or tolerate lifeless deception, is a far less significant sin, if you will, than lo nasha, which means you should not beguile, you should not deceive with destructive falsehoods. You know, one speaks of the victims of religion, the other speaks of the perpetrators of religion. Furthermore, as we strive to understand what Yahweh conveyed, it is also important to recognize that the primary and secondary definitions of nasa, which is the N-A-S-A with the shin versus the sin, or shemek, which are to lift up and to bear, are both awkward in each of these two sentences. I mean, the primary meaning of nasa, And the secondary meaning of nasa is to lift up and to bear. And in this sentence, to take the primary meaning of the simple shin S variation here, as it is pointed now by the Masoretes, to lift up and bear, very awkward in both sentences. And it's only by extrapolating lift up to mean advance or promote and bear to mean tolerate and support, which are derivatives lift up and bear. You know, lift up can be extrapolated to advance or promote, and bear can be extrapolated to tolerate and support. But unless you take that extrapolation to a symptom or a causal link to the primary and secondary meaning of the verb cannot be used in this context as nasa. However, that is not true with nasha, the sh sound. So since nasa's third definition is to forgive, and its fourth is to respect, and its fifth is to desire, the further we go down the line and hope to find a suitable connotation for nasa to work in this context, the further we get from it being acceptable. Now, that is the opposite of what's true with nasha. Now, the reason that there is this question, is it nasa or nasha, is because the oldest manuscript that we have of this particular section of the Torah is the Masoretic. We don't have a copy of it from the Dead Sea Scrolls. And the Dead Sea Scrolls, it would either be written with a Shemek or with the combination of the Shin Sin letter unpointed. The Shin Sin in modern Hebrew and in Babylonian Hebrew, the shape of the letter is the same. It's a shape of a W in English. And it either puts a dot on the left or the right leg upright of the of that W-looking letter. Well, those dots don't exist in the original Hebrew text, which means that we therefore must decide, did God intend to convey the meaning of nasha or nasa, and which one of those is the most likely? And this is the thing that I, by the way, that I love about examining Yahweh's testimony. He encourages us to think as opposed to just react to what others have said. We'll return to Shattering Myths, thinking in a moment. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. I'm your host, Yada. I'm doing something now that I happen to love, but if this were a religious movement, and it is not, it's opposed to religion. If I wanted a following, and I don't, I'm opposed to being followed. I'm not worthy of it. What we're doing now, we would never do. You see, in the religious community, they want you to trust them when they say, well, this is what God says, this is what you must do, and if you do this, you're right, if you do this, you're wrong. When someone instead comes to you and says, you know, I can't be certain here. There are some question marks as to what happened here. I'm telling you what's on the oldest manuscripts, telling you what the oldest text we have to reference this. I'm going to tell you the evolution of this letter between the Shemek, the Sin, and the Shin. And there's a difference between the meanings of these words, depending on which one is chosen. And because this is a real serious topic, it's important that we dive down and consider the possibilities. And so we really need to think about it, and I'm not going to ever make the claim that one choice is entirely wrong and the other choice is entirely right, but that instead we ought to closely examine this, carefully consider it, so that we individually can make our own decision and determine what we think that God has told us and how we should respond to it. Now, for me, that's the thrill of it all. That describes the nature of the entirety of the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. Is the living embodiment of what God's all about in terms of his communication with us. Let's go on a voyage of discovery. Let's think about these things. Let's examine the evidence. Let's have the joy of learning and of discovering and of thinking. The freedom of choice in this regard, regarding our conclusions and our responses. So I think this is exciting stuff. But, of course, if you were religious, this would be frightening stuff. Why don't you just tell me what the answer is? You know, that's why so many people say, you know, okay, well, an introduction to God is a 1,000-plus page book, and yada yada is a 2,000-page book. Just give me the short version. You know, in one paragraph, tell me what it is that I need to do. And I'll never do that. That isn't God's nature. He wants us to go on this voyage of eternity with him, where he's teaching, we're learning. He's guiding, we're engaging and following and walking along with him. I mean, that's his idea of a good time. And if it's not your idea of a good time, then you'd hate eternity with him. And God would be bugged by you being there. And so this is the very essence of what God is trying to convey to us and wants us to be doing. Now, I can tell you also that the version of this that exists in almost any Bible translation is entirely bogus. So while I won't tell you for certain, and we're going to continue to consider both Shoah and Nasha, while I won't tell you for certain that one choice versus the other is right, I will tell you for certain that the English translations are wrong. Almost every English translation of this says, you shall not take the Lord thy God's name in vain. That's what it says. You shall not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain. Nasa does not mean take. There is absolutely no way to extrapolate Nasa or Nasha to take. Lord does not appear in the text. Yahweh does appear in the text, and it was omitted. And Shoah can be extrapolated to mean vain only in the sense of failure, of ending up with a result that is destructive and counterproductive and lifeless, if you will. But it is an extreme extrapolation of the word, where the English word vain, you know, either means failed or are egotistical. And you can't take a name, and to take a name from a failed or egotistical point of view is absurd. So the English rendition is not only inconsistent with the words themselves and says something entirely different than what God etched in stone, it is nonsensical. You can't take a name in vain. Now, returning to the words themselves. Nasha's primary connotation, that's with the SH sound, is the primary connotation is to beguile. It is to delude, it is to deceive, it is to lead astray. It is an absolute perfect fit for an unforgivable crime. Even the secondary meaning of Nasha works, which is to unfairly enrich oneself by indebting others. These are things that God detests because they separate him from those who would otherwise be his children. Nasha isn't something Yahweh would be prone to forgive. It would be the very thing that a zealous and jealous God who is protective of his children would despise. It is the ultimate crime. It is one thing to victimize oneself. It is another to victimize others. It is one thing to be led away from God. It is another entirely to lead others away from God. I am a big fan of Nasha, although I'm willing to consider Nasha. Good morning and welcome back to Shattering Mist. As we consider these two potential meanings of Nasa versus Nasha, I just want to leave you with one thought, and then we'll move on to Shoah, which is the next verb. At the most broad interpretation possible, God is saying that those who embrace, those who accept, those who tolerate, those who promote that which is lifeless and deceptive, which would be religious and political, patriotic slogans and claims, cannot be forgiven. So it would be an utter rejection of political correctness, be an utter rejection of all religious and political claims. That's very broad. That's the broadest possible interpretation. That is the Masoretic interpretation, by the way. The narrowest and most likely, in my view, is that you should not deceive and delude. That It's the perpetrators of religion. It's the folks like Obama that lies every time he opens his mouth. And George Bush before him. Let's not pick just on the Democrats. This Pope who waltzed into a cathedral in Brazil today and paid homage to an idol. It is the perpetrators of religion and politics, those who in academia deceive in this regard. Those are the ones who will not be forgiven in this particular case. I think that is the most likely scenario. It's the most consistent with everything else that Yahweh has to say. But you should know that both are possible. The second verb we have to contend with is Shoah, although you won't find it in any lexicon written as Shoah. It is generally and usually transliterated Shav, S-H-A-V, with an apostrophe following it, showing what they would consider to be a silent letter. But that's wrong on three accounts. First, there is no letter or sound V in Hebrew. The wa is a vowel, and it conveys either the O or the U sound. And the concluding LF is pronounced either as an A or an E, and is usually the A, but can be either of those two vowels. Therefore, it is not a silent letter that ends the word. The most likely pronunciation based upon the letters is Shoah. But with decreasing reliability, it could be pronounced Shoei, Shua, or Shui. But under no circumstances can Shin, Wa, Aleph be Shav. Now that we know the range of possible pronunciations, our job has only begun. And that is because Shoah also conveys a range of meanings, albeit they are less, at least related, because one variation leads to the other. So these are related meanings. In other words, they're amplified meanings. And that's the nature of almost every word in every language. Shoah speaks of emptiness and nothingness, of worthlessness and failure, of lying and falsehood, as well as deception, idolatry, and futility. It is the kind of thing which causes someone to be ravaged, to be devastated, to be ruined, and to be laid waste, being hastily rushed over and hostily trodden down, leaving only lifelessness and desolation. Shoah is therefore the epitome of badly mistreating someone or something. You know, in all of the Torah's presentation regarding attitude, it is a quid pro quo. God says, if you value me, if you value your relationship with me, if you value my guidance and testimony, then I'm going to value you. If you love me, I'm going to love you. If you follow me, then I'm going to walk with you. If you listen to me, I'm going to even listen to you. But if you don't listen to me, I won't listen to you. I will never hear one of your prayers. If you don't observe my Torah, I'm going to reject you. If you don't answer my invitations, then you're going to die. You're going to cease to exist. I will view you as worthless. If you seek to know me, I will get to know you. But if you don't get to know me as I am, I have no interest in you. I'll just view you as worthless. No different than the soul of an ordinary garden slug. And so almost all of the Torah, prophets, and Psalms has this quid pro quo. We are viewed by God as we view God. He listens to us only when we listen to him. And so when we consider that and we look at Shoah as being lifeless, then being worthless, being nothingness, then what we see is that if we beguile people and cause them to be seen as worthless, as nothing, as leading to the consequence of death and destruction from Yah's point of view, then what we have done is we have caused them not to listen to Yahweh. We have caused them not to observe Yah's guidance. We've caused them to ignore Yahweh in some way. Particularly in this case, since it's a reference to Yahweh's name, if there is this would be something that causes individuals to discount the value of Yahweh's name, causing those individuals to be devalued by Yahweh. So keep that in mind as we consider the meanings of Shoah. Now, perhaps it oblivious to the meaning of Shoah and all of the emptiness and nothingness and worthless and failure and lying and falsehood, deception, idolatry, futility, ravage, devastation, ruin, being laid waste, all of those lifeless and desolation concept of Shoah, ignoring all of that meaning, most English Bibles simply distill Shoah down to in vain. And while vain does convey failure, most people don't use vain even today to mean failure. If someone says you are so vain, they're speaking of you are egotistical. The Hebrew preposition ba, denoting in, isn't in either sentence, by the way. So to say in vain would suggest that that ba, the preposition in, was used in conjunction with Shoah to convey in vain, but it's not there. Either of the two times the verb is used. All these things known, I have decided to embolden the translation of Nasha, and therefore emphasize the alternative meanings when I share it with you, so that we're considering both possibilities. Since God repeated his instruction twice, he gives us the ability to incorporate the full range of Shoah's meanings without complicating the sentence, and also both aspects of Nasa and Nasha, which is why we can amplify it in such a way that it reads very smoothly and conveys every possibility. And I shared that with us with you when we began this program. Let me read it to you again. You should never deceive or delude. That's lo nasha. Through the name or reputation, this is eth shem, of Yahweh, your God, Elohim. Advancing worthless and lifeless deceptions, laha shoah. For indeed, Yahweh will never forgive nor leave unpunished, lo naka, those who consistently deceive, actually beguile, or habitually delude, nasha, in association with his name and reputation, to promote in effect vain and ineffectual lies, which lead to lifelessness and destruction, Shoah. This is perhaps one of the most misunderstood yet powerful statements ever written. So it should not be surprising that clerics the world over have nullified its intent and caused God to appear trivial, even egotistical, perhaps even mean-spirited in the process. You know, to say that you shall not take my name in vain, I won't forgive you if you take my name in vain. I mean, why would God be so trivial as to say that and not even, by the way, include his name in the statement? I mean, it makes God look mean, unforgiving, egotistical. We, as we discovered, by the way, and translated correctly, it makes God appear zealous, jealous, caring, loving of his children, protective of his children, not wanting people to deceive his children, to mislead them. And saying that I'm going to be fair. I'm going to hold those who mislead, who lead people away from me through religion and politics, I'm going to hold them accountable. Yeah, one is fair, just, reasonable, consistent, appropriate, logical, rational. And the other, foolish. So which one do you think is true? Your English Bible or the actual words? As we discovered a moment ago, depending on how Nasa or Nasha is pointed, the Hebrew letters Nun, Sin, or Shin, Aleph, can be used to convey two distinct ideas. The Masoretic pointings suggest you shall not lift up, advance, support, accept, or tolerate. While the alternative rendering of these three letters warns us, you shall not deceive or delude, cleverly tricking people, beguiling them by causing them to miss the way. Since both definitions are potentially valid, since Nasa and Shav Shoah are repeated, we are compelled to consider both meanings. Therefore, this statement is a powerful warning to those who promote false and lifeless teaching in the name of God. It is a declaration against religion. Yahweh will not forgive those who unnecessarily nullify and destroy souls. Now, earlier, we invested considerable time unveiling the full implication of Shoah. We've been through this word once before on this program, which is errantly as transliterated, as I've said, as Shav in most lexicons. It is defined by Yahweh's prophets as empty lies and vain, worthless deceptions, which disassociate us from God by way of religious institutions. The Mizmor Psalms suggest that Shoah is the unforgivable sin of promoting vain and ineffectual delusions which lead to lifelessness and destruction. To this, our lexicons flesh out Shoah by defining it as something which ravages and devastates souls using empty promises and falsehoods. It is called vanity, futility, failure, deceit, deception, and fraud. It is ineffectual teaching, which leads to waste and ruin. We'll return to the final segment of Shattering Myths in a moment. Welcome to the final segment of Shattering Myths for today. By using Shoah in this, the third statement on the first of the two tablets, Yahweh is conveying the consequence of accepting deceitful religious deceptions. Souls are ruined. Your soul is wasted. Your soul ultimately dissipates into nothingness if you accept religious lies, which means that the believers will cease to exist. Now, that's the consequence. In religion, if you are the victim of religion, if you believe religion, if you rely on religion, if you embrace religion, if you go into a religious environment and bow down and pray and do all that kinds of stuff, if you associate yourself with religion, then your soul will cease to exist upon your death. If you promote religion, if you are making apologies for religion, if someone leaves your religion and you give them a hard time, as so many husbands do and even wives do of their husbands when they accept Yahweh's covenant, if you are promoting religion, if you are discouraging someone from walking away from religion, then you're going to be judged and you'll be held accountable. And the consequence ultimately will be that your soul will not be destroyed, but that your soul will be forever estranged from God, placed in Sheol, which is ultimately like a black hole. It's a lightless place, infinite in time, and you will be eternally separated. That's the penalty for leading people astray. It's only fair. And so when we consider the issues associated with this, what we find is that religion is not a victimless crime, not in God's point of view. And that is why Yahweh holds clerics accountable, punishing them for destroying the souls of those who put their faith in them. The divine introduction is now complete. We have learned that Yahweh is God's name and that He alone is God. He is our Savior, the one who liberated us from religious and political oppression, from works-based salvation schemes, and most all from judgment. Our very existence is predicated upon forming an exclusive relationship with Him. Yahweh is opposed to the creation of religious imagery and political imagery, to us bowing down in a religious or a political setting, and to us ministering on behalf of false gods. Yahweh is emotional and He is possessive. He is intolerant of infidelity. God once was so sure that his creation, you and I, would corrupt His word, and I did for a very long time, He warned us that twisting and manipulating His testimony would be devastating to our children. As a preemptive strike against Pauline doctrine and Christianity, He declared that His merciful that he is himself merciful and that he would personally do everything which is required to deliver unearned and undeserved favor to thousands, not to billions. But this gift is only for those who approach him in love and who carefully observe his instructions. The path to him is something that Christians never consider. His instructions is something they reject. It was a preemptive strike against Christianity, even against Judaism, because they have their Talmud and their rules. And, of course, against Islam, if you're dumb enough to believe that the Quran affirms the Torah. It was a preemptive strike, one not heeded by the religious. Yahweh tells us that promoting lifeless deceptions in his name and his reputation is an unforgivable sin, at least the continuance of that practice, replete with an appropriate punishment, which is eternal separation. The victims of such delusions, those who accept them, will cease to exist, their souls dissipating into nothingness. Once again, for your benefit and for mine, here is Yah's third and final statement, as it was written on the first of the two tablets. You should never deceive or delude, lo nasha. You should never deploy clever tricks to enrich oneself by indebting others. You should never beguile people, causing them to miss the way, or lo nasa. You should never lift up or bear. You should never actually support or advance, nor literally forgive, nor tolerate, nor promote yourself through the name and reputation of Yahweh your God, advancing worthless and lifeless deception, la ha shoa, deploying that which advances devastating dishonesty, nullifying one's existence, leading to emptiness and nothingness. Deceitful and lifeless lies which are ineffectual and futile. For indeed, Yahweh will never forgive or leave unpunished those who consistently deceive, actually beguile, or habitually delude in association with his name to promote and effect vain and ineffectual lies which lead to lifelessness and to destruction. I am Yada. This has been Shattering Mess. We'll be with you again tomorrow.